We're holding in the parasha, we were discussing midata bitachon. When it comes to bitachon, we have to be sane. We have to be normal. Bitachon doesn't mean, oh, everything's okay, God's running the show. Bitachon means, I have faith that God's running the show, and together with that, I will do my hishtadlut. There was once a person who came over to the rabbi and said, I don't believe in God. So the rabbi told him, I don't believe in God either. So he said, what? So he said, yeah, the God that you're talking about, that you don't believe in, I don't either believe in. And let's talk about what God is. And then I'll tell you the God I believe in, and maybe you'll believe in Him too. But the God you're assuming without learning about Him that you don't believe in, yeah, well, I don't believe in Him either. So we have to know what we're talking about when we speak about God. And the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu and Avram, Yitzhak and Yaakov was that they attained the level where they understood what God was. And that's why God made treaties and pacts with them. And God gave the Torah through Moshe, and God chose Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and we say Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzhak, Elokei Yaakov. That God is the God of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. They attained the level of understanding and connection with Hashem that God is God connected with them. And that's why at the end of the parasha, when the parasha says, if we don't keep the Shemitah, God will exile us, and all the terrible things that the parasha says, then God says, you do tshuva, I'll take you back for the sake of Yaakov, Yitzhak, and Avram. God says, I'll take you back for their sake because God has a treaty with them. And we say that Tamas Chutavot, the merits of the forefathers, we can no longer reap benefit from. But the Brit Avot is not Tama, but the pact that God made with the forefathers, that is not undone, that remains forever. God tells the Jewish people the mitzvah of Shemitah, and the question is, what's it doing over here? We had a whole Sefer Vayikra where the Torah discussed the different sacrifices that we're supposed to bring. And then we had Achrimos and Kedoshim, the laws of being holy people, and then Parshas Emor, the commandments of the Kohanim, the holiness of the Kohanim. What are we doing talking about Shemitah? So one understanding is that the end of last week's Parsha, the Torah said, and you'll make it to the holiness of the Holy Land, and you'll maintain these laws of holiness, of not having improper relationships, and then you won't be kicked out of the land. So now the Torah is continuing, and you want to stay in the land, here's another precondition to staying to the land, the laws of Shemitah, and that's why the Torah lists the laws of Shemitah. The Ramban explains that this belongs over here because the order of things was God made a pact with the Jewish people at Sinai. The Jewish people became Jewish. God made them into Gerim. They had the sacrifice of a Ger, they had the sprinkling of the blood, and the revelation at Sinai. And then Moshe went up to Sinai, and they had their first pact with Hashem, and then Moshe went up to Sinai and got the commandments that are in Mishpatim. Moshe came down and found the Jewish people serving the idol, the golden calf. They made a breach in their first pact with God. And the mitzvos until Kisisa, so we have the mitzvos of the first pact. And now, they broke the first pact. So God sends Moshe back up, and there's going to be a second pact. God says, I'll forgive them, and I'll make a treaty with them. So we have the second pact. And the second pact, well, that's what we have over here. The second pact runs through the mitzvos that were made in Mishpatim, all the mitzvos until Kitisa of the first pact. Plus, God said, now I'm going to give you an enumeration of certain things that I didn't enumerate in the first pact. There are going to be more details. And one of the details that God adds on to the second pact, God says, there will be alot and klalot. There are going to be curses. If we don't keep the Torah, then God says, now I'm going to spell out the punishments. And the other detail which God added to the second pact are the laws of Shemitah. And that's why the parasha stresses in our parasha, Behar Sinai, that these were the commandments of Shemitah that were given at Mount Sinai when God made the second pact with us. And the end of the Sefer, the end of Vayikra, God states, these are the laws, the mitzvos, the statutes that God gave Moshe at Sinai. It's reinstating that this was the second pact that was made at Sinai. So God tells us that we have a commandment to keep Shabbos. Shabbos for the land. Seventh year. The land is supposed to lay fallow. And Shabbos for the land is supposed to be like Shabbos for the world. Just like Shabbos, we said, points to the fact that God created the world and rested on the seventh day, so too letting the land go fallow on the seventh year. Also, we are signifying that God created the world, and our parnasa is in His hands, and the growth of the crops is in His hands, and that God said we should let it rest on the seventh year, and that's what we're doing. We have a tradition that the Gemara brings, Amar Rav Katina, the world was created 6,000 years, there's going to be all kinds of development, and in the 7,000 year, the world will be destroyed. And v'nisigav Hashem levado, God will be uplifted, God will be alone. What does that mean? So some want to say, there are two understandings in the Medrash. One understanding says everything's going to be destroyed. And that's how some want to understand. The Rambam says that's not the case. that the 7,000 years is going to be the seventh series of 1,000 years, the seventh thousand, the last 7,000 years, are going to be a period where the world will exist. And it's not that the world will be destroyed, but rather there will no longer be preoccupation that had been until now. The destruction means the destruction of the occupations of the world that were there until now. That until now, everyone's busy with making parnasa, and each one's trying to outdo the other one, and that 7,000 year, the years, are going to be years where people are going to work on just getting to know Hashem, trying to connect to Hashem. That's how the Rambam learns, that's what's going to be in that last 1,000 years. And there's an allusion to that in this, that we're working the land for 6 years, and in the seventh year we rest. The Torah says, 6 years you shall plant your land. And from here we derive that the Shemitah is only relevant when each one knows what is his land. And we only started counting the Shemitah cycles, the 777, when we entered the land of Israel, conquered it and divided the land of Israel. It took 7 years to conquer the land of Israel, and another 7 years to divide it till everyone knew what was their portion. Only after that do we start counting the series of seven. There's very interesting Rambam over here. The Rambam says, and the way you count the 7 years, and he starts listing a whole way how to count the 7 years from the time we entered the land of Israel. And then he says, after he enumerates how we do it, he says, but our tradition is not this way. This is the way it would seem to me, but the tradition that we have, and the tradition that's followed in the land of Israel, and the tradition that all the Gonim says is differently, and that's how we go la'alacha. Even though the Rambam had explained one way, he shows how the Gonim and the tradition has it a different way, and that's how we do it. The Torah says anything that grows during the seventh year without our planting, we're not allowed to harvest as though it's our own. Those are called sefichei shviz. Safiach means something that's added on. Ordinarily, when you plant, you have the things that grow, and then the things that grow of their own accord. They are nispach. They are the additions. They are the things that grew of their own accord without your planting them. Sometimes as you harvest it, some kernels fell down, and they grow on their own. So those things are called safichim, the things that are in an ordinary crop, they are the additions. On shvius, on shemitah, they are the only things that grow, because you're not planting. So the Torah says, you're not allowed to harvest them as though they were your own crop. There's a mitzvah in Torah. What happens when you're in the middle of the seventh year, everyone takes in their crop, and then there's no more food left in the field. So the Torah says the food is supposed to be for you and animals and the wild animals of the field. From here our sages derive a concept of bi'ur. Bi'ur literally means to get rid of, like bi'ur chametz. The Torah tells us that so long as there's food out for the wild animals, you could take food in for yourself and your domesticated animals. The second there's no longer crops outside for the wild animals, you are no longer allowed to harbor the food for yourself. So the Rambam is of the opinion that that means when the time of beer comes, you have to get rid of everything, burn it. It's over. You could finish eating. Oh wait, that's not the Rambam. There are two understandings as to what has to happen here. For example, you're going to buy food next year's Shemitah. This coming year's Shemitah. So ordinarily we'd say all the food is holy. In a second we're going to discuss how the country functions during the Shemitah year. But let's say you manage to get some food, some wine, that's Shemitah wine. So the time for beer of wine, I think, is Hanukkah or Purim, the year after Shemitah. Then there are no longer grapes out in the field. So when that time comes, according to the Rambam, you have to pour out all your holy Shemitah wine outside. Ordinarily, during the Shemitah year, all the food is holy. You're not allowed to destroy the food. Any food that's edible by man, you have to eat. That means if you have children, and you give them a banana to eat, and the kid starts mopping it around his face and says, I don't want to eat it, so you have a problem. You're supposed to eat the leftover banana that he doesn't want to eat, because that banana is holy. Anything that grows during the Shemitah year in the land of Israel is holy. Food that's edible to mankind may not be given to animals. Food that's edible to animals may not be used for destructive purposes. All the food is holy. You want to eat a cucumber and peel the cucumber. Well, most Israelis eat cucumber with the peel. Are you allowed to discard of that cucumber peel? Even if you are allowed to discard of it, you have to discard of it in a holy manner. So the food that's holy with Shemitah holiness, there are special guidelines which we will Bezat Shem learn as to how we treat that food. But when the time of beer comes, which is different for each crop, that there is no longer food out for the animals, so then the Torah says we have to be meva'er. According to the Rambam, it means that we have to literally get rid of it. The Ramban says we have to make it hefker. And this is the opinion of the Rash. This is what Michal quoted a minute ago. It's brought in the Yerushalmi, it's brought in the Tosefta, that you take the food and you put it outside in public domain and you say, whoever wants, come take it. Oh, no one come took it. You could take it too. You could take it back home. So my father-in-law was once standing outside their apartment building when a neighbor took out some 15 cases of wine and said, it's Hefker, whoever wants, come take it. So my father-in-law said, you serious? So the guy said, yeah, I have to say it's Hefker. It's Hefker, you want, take a case. So wait, so the Yerushalmi says, when you do this, wait till you stop hearing footsteps in the marketplace. Go out to the marketplace when you hear that people are starting to leave and no one's around, then say Hefker, and then after you wait a few seconds and no one took it, then take it back home. So that's the opinion that most people go with today. It's the opinion brought by the Rash and the Ramban and others, that beer means that at that point you have to make it Hefker. You have to remove it from your possession. But you can take it back into your possession once you've done that. Now the Ramban quote, yeah.
Now, does, somebody have to hear you say it's Hefker? Or
there are different opinions as to whether someone has to hear it. Some say, and that seems to be the opinion that people go with today, that you have to put it in public domain and say it's Hefker, but not that necessarily someone has to hear it. There are, if I remember correctly, there is an opinion that says that at least three people have to hear it. It has to be where three people hear it. I think the opinion that people go with today is that it's enough that you were in public domain. You don't necessarily have to have people hear it. The Tosefta tells us that the courts saw that people weren't keeping the laws of Shemitah. So what the courts did was they'd send their own messengers out there and they'd watch over the field and they'd harvest all the food from the field and then they'd press the olives and press the grapes and make wine and make oil, and whoever wanted could come on any given day and take enough for three meals. And this was a way of ensuring that, being that it's the court's representatives, it's not private individuals working their own fields, and they're representative of the klal. These workers are being paid by the court and they're representing the public, the everyone. So that's permissible. And then there's no concept of beer, because the Torah says you have to get rid of it from your home. Well, it's not in anyone's home. It's in Otsar Betin. It's in Bezdin storage houses. And then, so long as it's in Bezdin storage houses, it doesn't have to be gotten rid of. And Bezdin could give it to whoever they want until they finish their storage houses. The Torah says, with regard to Yovel, on Yom Kippur, we have to blow the shofar. And this is a mitzvah for everyone. Bezdin blows the shofar, and then everyone on Yovel, on the Yom Kippur of Yovel, has to blow shofar. Blow shofar means we blow like on Rosh Hashanah. Tkiya, Shvarim, Trua, Tkiya, nine blows. The Torah says we have to make Yovel for all of the inhabitants of the land of Israel. And from here we derive that the concept of Yovel is only relevant when all the inhabitants are here, meaning when all the tribes are here, when we have representation of all 12 tribes. Now the Rambam says that 46 years prior to the Churban, 10 tribes were exiled, right? And that's it. We lost it. From 46 years before the destruction of the first temple, there's no Yovel, and there never was again, says the Rambam. During the whole period of the second temple, the 420 years of the second temple, by the way, the first temple, number one, was for 410. One goes with 410. The second temple, number two, was for 420 years. That's an easy way to remember it. So the whole 420 years that we were here during the period of the second temple, says the Rambam, we didn't have Yovel, because the 10 tribes were missing. Rabbeinu Tam says it's not so. There is an opinion, Rabbi Yochanan's opinion in the Gemara, that after the 10 tribes were exiled, the prophet Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu, went and brought back the 10 tribes. And then Rabbeinu Tam says we rule like Rabbi Yochanan, that the 10 tribes were brought back, and they were under the reign of Yoshiyahu, and all 12 tribes were exiled when the first temple was destroyed, and as such, during the period of the second temple, Rabbeinu Tam is of the opinion that we did have Yovel. What difference does it make? So there are many laws that are contingent on Yovel. We say that so long as there is Yovel, we have the following mitzvot. We have the concept of Eved Ivri, a Jewish slave. We have Batei Rechoma, the law of homes within a walled city that they aren't, when they're sold, you have a year to redeem them and then they're sold permanently. We have the concept of Sde Achuzah, Sde Charamim, as we'll see later. The concept of Ger Toshav, that we could have a non-Jew accept the Noahide laws in the land of Israel, is contingent on Yovel. And the concept of Shemitah is only relevant mid-Rabbanon, now that we don't have Yovel, that we don't have all 12 tribes here. The difference between Shemitah and Yovel is that on Shemitah, all loans are undone. gentlemen, you have to know this. At the end of the Shemitah year, meaning Rosh Hashanah, next, not this coming Rosh Hashanah, in a year and a half Rosh Hashanah, anyone you gave a loan to, the loan is undone. There's Shemitah, Shamot Kolban, Mashiach Yado, Asher Yashiv Re'eu, the Torah says, the loans are nullified. Our sages instituted that we could get around it by doing a prusbul, that we write a contract, and there, you'll see contracts available towards then the next year, in which we give over our loan to the court to collect. And the court's loans are not nullified at the end of Shemitah. Yovel does not undo loans. Yovel makes the slaves go free, which Shemitah does not, and Yovel also makes the land acquisitions return to their original owner when Yovel is relevant. Yeah?
How is it related to
Gerut Moshav? We derive from the Psukim that they're connected. So we have 8 levels of tzedakah, the Rambam says. The highest level of tzedakah is what our parsha says, that we help the person that he doesn't reach a level of tzedakah, that we help him in, before he breaks down. The next level of tzedakah is when one gives tzedakah, he doesn't know who he's giving to, and the poor man doesn't know who he's getting from. And this is if you give to an organization, where the organization gets money, but let's assume that the organization has a head that you could rely on him, that he's a tzaddik and he's doing the decisions correctly. The third level of tzedakah is that you know who you're giving to, but the poor man doesn't know who he's getting from. That's what the tzaddikim used to do. They'd leave money by people's homes to give them tzedakah. That's the third level of tzedakah. The fourth level of tzedakah is that the poor man knows who he's getting from, but the one who's giving doesn't know who he's giving to. And that's what our sages would sometimes do. They'd take sashes of money and drop them behind their back, and the poor people would know to follow them and pick up those sashes of money. They'd know who they were getting from, but the tzaddik wouldn't want to know who he was giving to. The next level of tzedakah is that he gives the poor man before the poor man even asks. He puts it in his hand before he asks. So he knows who he's giving to, he knows who he's getting from, but he didn't get to ask. The next level of tzedakah is that the man asked and you gave it to him. The next level of tzedakah is that one gives him less than the man needs, but he gives it to him with a good countenance. And the last level, the lowest level of tzedakah, is when one gives it with a sour face. And he's not giving as much as the ani needs. Meaning, if a person needs to marry off his daughter, say he needs 10,000 shekel, let's say, or probably needs more than that, just the refrigerator, the stove and the oven, the stove and whatever, washing machine, just that costs 10,000 shekel. So let's say he needs 35,000 shekel to marry off a child. It's still a mitzvah, but it's the lowest level of the mitzvah. There are 8 levels of the mitzvah. The highest level is when you help a person that he doesn't need tzedakah. So that's why giving to gmach is sometimes the highest level. You give it to an organization that gives out free loans. That's a very high level of tzedakah. That's possibly the highest level of tzedakah. This is the Rambam's enumeration. Now, when someone gives his children food, meaning when a person has a child, he's 10 years old, he's 12 years old, the kid can make his own living. He could go out and work delivering newspapers. So halachically, he's not obligated to. He should. That's the first tzedakah he should give. He should give that child to eat. But that's considered tzedakah. There was once a guy learning here in Israel, and his father wanted to support him. And his father didn't keep Shabbos, didn't keep kosher, didn't keep anything. And he came to his rabbi and he said, should I accept it? I don't want that. My father's doing all these prohibitions. I should accept money from him. So the rabbi told him, look, can you think of any mitzvah your father keeps? So he said, no, offhand, I can't think of any. So he said, here, if your father gives you the money, he's performing a mitzvah. The one mitzvah you can think of that he's going to keep, you don't want to let him do. He wants to perform a mitzvah. He wants to help you. You're learning. He wants to help you out. Do you want to take that away from him too? So we have to remember that even that is a form of a mitzvah. When one supports his children after they reached an age where they could support themselves, that's also tzedakah. And tzedakah also applies to our relatives. People are sometimes apt to give tzedakah to other people, but if their brother asks them for a loan, or their nephew or their uncle needs a loan, then they don't want to do it. And we have to remember that's not right. The first people we should try to help out is our family members, and the highest level of tzedakah is helping someone so he won't come to need tzedakah. And that's in our parsha, to help a person out so he won't reach the level of tzedakah. The Torah gives us an ordering here. The Torah says Shemitah, what happens if one sells his objects, one sells his field, one sells his home. Our sages said this is teaching us something. Shemitah is a difficult mitzvah to be careful with. If a person isn't careful and he's over on avak shvius, even just an extension of shvius, you know, if you have a fruit that's holy with shvius, and you say, here, I'll sell you the fruit. You give the guy the fruit, you sell it. You're not allowed to sell fruit of shvius. You sell it and you get money. So we say the fruit still has the holiness of shvius, the holiness of Shemitah, and now the money has the holiness of Shemitah, which means that you'll have to get rid of that money to buy food with it and give the holiness over to the food and eat that food during the Shemitah cycle, or else when the time of beer comes, you're in trouble. So if one isn't careful with the holiness of Shvius, so the Torah says that's the ordering of our parsha. He'll end up having to sell his objects. He'll end up having to sell his field. He'll end up having to sell his daughter till he'll reach a point where he'll have to sell his daughter till he'll reach a point where he'll have to borrow with interest. Our parsha says not to borrow with interest until he finally is all out of money and sell himself to a non-Jew who serves idols, and he'll be in the presence of idol worship. And this shows us this stresses the how careful we have to be even with small averas. Our sages taught us avera gureras avera. A person does something small, it'll bring him to something bigger. This also shows us the ordering, that one should sell his daughter before one takes a loan with ribis. People think that if I take a loan with interest, what's the big deal? And our sages always had the foresight to warn us, if you take a loan with interest, then it just grows and grows and grows, and ultimately it kills a person. Our sages said, if a person sells his daughter, so he'll get loans, he'll get family members to give him loans, he'll buy her back after a day, after a week, after a year, he'll buy her back. A person takes a loan with interest, that just grows. He might never get out of it, and very often people don't. That's the problem with credit card debt. We're not talking about interest like you go to buy a house and you take a loan from a bank in a kosher way, so you have to pay a certain interest that's normal. Hopefully you'll be able to pay that back. We're talking about a situation like if you do it halachically correct, if you do it from a non-Jewish bank or from a bank with a heter iska, a Jewish bank, so it's okay. But if it's a normal normal amount of interest, the problem is that people will overcharge their credit card and then they're paying 10% or 12% or 20%. Of interest on their loan, and that's the type of interest which the Torah advised us against. If it's from a Jew, it's prohibited, and if it's from a non-Jew, then it's just ill-advised. The second parasha we're going to read on Shabbos is B'chukosai, and the Torah gives us all kinds of promises that things will go well, and the Torah says it'll be peaceful. So that's referring to the days of Mashiach, which if we keep the Torah, then the days of Mashiach will come. And we'll reach a point where the wolf will be able to live with a lamb. So what's pshat in that? That it'll be so peaceful that a lion will be able to live with a lamb, a sheep, a kid will be able to play with a vicious serpent. So we don't know what's pshat in that. One understanding, the Medrash says, brings two understandings, Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Shimon says, pshat, that's what's going to happen. There's going to be a change in nature. If the Jewish people attain the level that they should, they keep the Torah, then God will change the nature of the world, just as we find that on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, a serpent never harmed a person. This was the level of holiness which we attained, that we could only affect that area. If we'd attain the highest level that the Torah wants us to attain, so the whole world will be on that level, that the nature of the animals will change, and animals won't harm one another. And the Ramban goes with that. The Ramban says that the land of Israel, when the Jewish people attain the highest level which they should, will become like the world was before the sin of Adam HaRishon, and the nature of the animals will change. There's another opinion brought in the Medrash, the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, where he says that what the verses are promising us is that we'll inhabit our cities very well. And we'll have fully inhabited cities. And when you have cities that are fully inhabited, so then animals don't come in. You don't see lions running across Jerusalem. You don't see snakes running across the street. So you have a situation where kids could play around, and when they see a hole, they could stick their hand in. And they don't have to worry that there's a snake there because the world is inhabited. And the Rambam goes with that understanding of Rabbi Yehuda, that the nature of the world isn't going to change, but the inhabitants of the world will grow in a way that people can be confident. And if this is the understanding, then to an extent we could feel like we've attained it already. I mean, here in Jerusalem, you go to any domesticated city that's inhabited, you don't see wild animals running around. How are we to understand all the physical promises of the Torah? So the Rambam says that the Torah basically tells us, you keep the Torah, I'll help you keep the Torah. If you keep the Torah, I'll give you the physical needs that will help you keep the Torah. And if you don't, then you won't have them. And that's why our sages always said they want to reach the days of the Mashiach. Not because they were looking for all the good of the days of the Mashiach, because they were looking for a period where they could study Torah peacefully. God says, you keep the Torah, I'll place my Mishkan within your midst. That's the Mikdash that will come. I won't kick you out of the Holy Land. And that's an allusion to the time when we won't be kicked out of life. It means a period of Olam Haba. And I will walk in your midst. That's a remes to Gan Eden. And that's why some want to say that our Parsha, Parshas Bechukosai, is where we have the source for the gifts that God promises us if we keep the Torah. That's a basic question that people often ask. Why doesn't the Torah mention Olam Haba, Gan Eden, Tchias HaMesim? So they want to say that our Parsha is an allusion to that. Others want to say that all the precepts, the concepts that the Torah is based on, but they're deep, secret concepts, the Torah alludes to but doesn't spell out. And that's another understanding as to why they aren't mentioned directly. The Torah says if we don't listen to Hashem, then all the curses that ensue. So it says, Lotishmu, Lotasu, Timasu, Tigal Nafshechem, Levilti Asot, Et Kol Mitzvotai. So our sages broke it down. That it all begins with not wanting to listen to Torah. If a person doesn't want to hear the words of Torah, that'll bring it to a stage where Lotasu, he doesn't keep the Torah. If he doesn't keep the Torah, he'll reach a stage where he'll be disgusted by those who do keep the Torah. And then the next step is he'll be disgusted with the Chachamim, he'll be disgusted with the sages who teach the Torah, and he'll reach a stage where he wants to prevent others from keeping Torah, and finally the stage where he doesn't believe in mitzvos at all, doesn't want to even keep bris milah. And that's why our sages taught us that the way we're supposed to behave is to run even for a small mitzvah, because we always have a choice how to guide our lives. If we run for something even small that's positive, it'll move us forward to something else that's positive. And if we allow ourselves to start doing something even small that's negative, that'll evolve, as we saw with the story of Shemitah, into something big that's negative. The Torah warns us from switching. When we have an animal that's supposed to be hektish, the concept of tmura, saying this is in place of that. So the concept is as follows. The Rambam explains in the Mor Nevuchim. When we have an animal that we want to bring as a sacrifice, we're supposed to recognize this is something holy. This isn't something for my own personal use. I said this animal is going to be a carbon, this animal is going to be a carbon. I don't have to start looking for personal gain from that. And that's why once we designate an animal for a carbon, we're not allowed to shear it, we're not allowed to use it for our personal work. We have a concept of me'ilo, we're not allowed to take it out of Hegdish, and if one by mistake does, he has to pay that value plus a fifth and bring a special sacrifice. The concept of switching of tmura that the Torah prohibits, that's even if you have a better animal. You have one sheep and you say, this sheep is better, I'll switch this sheep for that one. The Torah says that's prohibited, explains the Rambam, because the Torah was concerned that people are stingy. That's our nature. And our avarice nature is going to lead us to a situation where once we designate an animal for a carbon, if we want to eat that animal, so we'll say, I'll switch this animal for a different animal, and we'll easily say, oh, that animal's better. When in truth, it isn't better. But we won't be so careful with it. And the Torah didn't want us to treat the things of Hegdash lightly, so the Torah forbade switching an animal once it was designated for the temple. We can't switch it even if we want to convince ourselves that the other animal is better. And if you want to redeem something that you've designated for the temple, the Torah said, add a fifth. Because when you evaluate something and you say, oh, I promised this animal for Hegdash, how much is this animal already worth? You know how it goes. When we evaluate something that we're about to give up, so how much is it worth? Well, if I want it, so then, the difference between buyer and seller. So the Torah was concerned. When you're going to have to pay for that animal to redeem it, you'll say, it's worth, and you'll give it a small value. So the Torah said, add a fifth. And this is to ensure that we'll really pay the proper amount and we won't treat the things that are holy in a light-headed fashion. I want to end with one point. The Torah says, if a person becomes poor and he has to sell part of his property, and the Torah is teaching us something like, with describing it this way, the Torah is teaching us rules of finance, that firstly, a person shouldn't sell property. You have property, so property is something of value. A person shouldn't treat it lightly and just sell it. If you have property and it's good property, hold on to it. And if a person is in a situation where he's going to sell the property, he shouldn't sell all of the property. A person is supposed to maintain some of it in order to make money from. And this is a concept in general. People will very often take something that's making money and switch it for money. And the fact that, let's say a person has a business that's making $10,000 a year, or making $100,000 a year, and he could sell it for $2 million, so he'll be apt to sell it. And our sages taught us that something that's making money is worth a lot of money. And even if you think you should sell it, you should always have something that's making money. It's not enough to have money. So if a person's selling his field, he should sell part of the field and retain part of the field. And our sages always instructed us to divide our money. Some of it should be liquid, some of it should be invested in real estate, and some of it should be in business. And this is to ensure that we should diversify our investments. And our parsha again stresses, don't sell all of your property. Even if you're in a state where something happened and a person has to sell, he should always retain part of it. He should have some source of income. Yeah, Ari. Okay, yeah.
I learned by Rav Siegel this morning that the Pasuk says Shabbat Hashem, and then it says Shabbat Shabbaton. So what you were saying was that a sacrifice would be the sacrifice that the Korban was for Hashem, so that's Shabbat Hashem, and then it's Shabbat Shabbaton. That's the benefits of the Kiddusha of the fruits of Shemitah is for man, because Shabbaton is something that for man is involved. But I think really that there's a connection between Shemitah, that if we keep Shemitah, we'll continue to be Jews, because actually it will remind us of that Hashem is providing us everything and protecting us. And then we won't serve Avodah Zarah. Shabbat is very connected to Shabbat, is our protection against Avodah Zarah. That's it.
Yeah, the Ramban goes that route, what you're saying. Maybe that's another point we should speak about for a second. The concept of vacation. The Torah tells us we're supposed to spend 1/7 of our time at least vacationing. Meaning Shabbos, that's 1/7 of the work week, 1/7 of the week. You spend 6 days working, 1 day you're supposed to spend resting and enjoying what you've worked. Enjoying in a holy way, but enjoying. We have the holidays. And we also have 1 year out of each 7 that we're supposed to take a break. And this is something to think about. The Avodah Zarah of our time is work. There are many workaholics. And the Torah teaches us that we're supposed to take a break. And during that break, we're supposed to grow in Torah, in Yiras Shemayim, in Kedusha, in developing our family. Our married listeners, we don't have any married people here anymore. We had a few minutes ago, but... except for me, okay. No. So I'm talking to myself too, you're right. It's a good idea to also take time out to go out on dates with your wives. People stop dating when they get married, and it's not a good idea. You get married, you should also go out on a date. I just heard this week about a woman who insists that she and her husband go out once a week. They go out, and when someone asked her, why are you so insistent, once a week, every week you have to go out? So she said, yeah, because it's much cheaper than therapy. So I think whatever it takes, if it's a walk, if it's going out, but it's important. It's important to go out, even when there are a lot of kids. Couples have to take the time. Yeah, Ari.
I don't remember.
Okay.
It was
David. David, you want something?
I was going to say that. I remember my mom, she took a sabbatical year. She's a teacher. She took a sabbatical year.
If you could. Yeah, it's it's a good idea whenever you can, but even if a person can't do it in his business in the form of a year, but they have during the summer months in Funovich every year, they have a week or two where they have shiurim just for the working people. People take their vacation time during certain weeks in the summer, and then they have, it's called Yalchei Kala. They have periods where they give shiurim just for the people who are working, so they could learn, so they could get back into things. And it's important when a person can to try and do it. Yeah?
I remember now. There's a Roman general, it's my dad's brother. So the Jews are the laziest bunch of people. Once every 7 days, they take the day off. And if that's not enough, once every 7 years, they take the whole year off. And if that's not enough, he said once every 49 years, or 50 years.
That
now,
so
49 years. They take it
another year off again. It's even bigger. So, a bunch of labor. Yeah, but it's productive. See, it's productive. It works. Shemitah. Yovel is preceded by Shemitah.